Cebu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Gorgeous Christmas Tree Fundraiser on Saturday, December 16th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Community of Christ Church in Portland. Food by Design is offering live native 5-foot-tall Doug firs in pots for the holidays. Afterwards, they will plant them in the Columbia Gorge as part of the restoration efforts. This community pickup day event will also feature hot cocoa, music, and festivities. Again, that's the Gorgeous Christmas Tree Fundraiser on Saturday, December 16th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Community of Christ Church, 4837 Northeast Cooch in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11:30, Words and Pictures visits the Wordstalks Festival with speaks with graphic novelist Gabrielle Bell about her new book, Everything is Flammable. But next, on Between the Covers, Meg Kearney talks about her book, When You Never Said Goodbye, a novel in poems and journal entries. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
Had that dream again of asters and blackbirds. You like a page torn just outside my door.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Meg Kearney, author of the new book, When You Never Said Goodbye, a novel in poems and journal entries. When You Never Said Goodbye is the final book in a trilogy following the teen years of Lizzie McLean, an adopted daughter searching for her birth mother. The first two books, also novels in verse, are The Secret of Me, published in 2005, and The Girl in the Mirror from 2012. Meg's work also includes two books of poetry for adults, An Unkindness of Ravens and Home by Now, in addition to Trooper, a picture book for young readers, illustrated by E.B. Lewis. Meg is founding director of the Solstice Low Residency Master of Fine Arts and Creative Writing Program at Pine Manor College in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Before joining Pine Manor, she was associate director of the National Book Foundation, which sponsors the National Book Awards. She also taught poetry at the New School University in New York City. Meg Kearney, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be here.
Meg, you're in Portland now to teach workshops on writing poetry for both grade school students and teens. What do you tell your workshop students about poetry to inspire them to write their own?
Number one, I want them to know that they can write anything they want to write. You know, I tell them often we have a little editor who sits on our shoulder and says, you know, you can't write that, or, you know, you're not supposed to say that, or that's the worst thing you ever wrote, you know. And that's the editor that you have to shut up when you write your first draft. And that's kind of the first thing you really have to plow through, whether you're, you know, a author with a dozen books out, or if you're just an elementary school student who's writing her first poem. We all have that voice inside us that we have to do battle with.
You go through the same thing? Did you start writing poetry at a young age? And if you did, what inspired you when you started?
Yeah, I did. I started writing short stories in second grade, and I turned to poetry in sixth grade and kind of never looked back.
I'd like to get to the book. I have a lot of questions about the trilogy.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed reading it. A new book is When You Never Say Goodbye, so that's the final book in the trilogy. The trilogy begins with The Secret of Me, followed by The Girl in the Mirror. And these are all written for a young adult audience, and you've also written two collections of poetry for adult readers. What are the considerations when writing for younger readers? Characters, story, vocabulary?
Well, a lot of people think that writing for young people is somehow easier than it is writing for adults, and that's so not true. You know, it's writing is hard. It's hard work, even though I love it. And I think respecting the reader is the number one thing. You do have to think about vocabulary. But if you're writing for young adults, you know, YA, what they call YA, pretty much anything goes in terms of subject matter these days. It's all about, you know, being sensitive to how you present that subject matter, but you can talk about just about anything that affects the lives of young people.
The publishers don't place any constraint on that then for young
right,
audience.
Yeah.
Though some high schools, I guess, do.
Some high schools do, you know, and usually it's the banned books that the kids want to read the most.
Right, which is good for the author.
Right.
Now, you're a poet, so it's only natural that you write the trilogy in verse, of course, but did you initially consider telling the story in prose, and what are the challenges of telling the story in poems?
I never did consider telling it in prose. I tend to tell my stories in poems. And so when I had a couple of friends of mine, kind of a rock star now of young adult literature named Jacqueline Woodson, and another writer named Norma Fox Mazur, who also wrote fiction for young adults, they were both really pushing me to write for young people. And they were both writing novels for teenagers. And I really resisted that. I couldn't imagine how you can sustain something as long as a novel in prose, because everything I wrote was very short, you know.
In poetry, you mean?
Yeah, so no, in prose. So I would say, no, I'm the poet, you know. So.
Oh, wow. Oh, I would have thought the exact opposite.
It wasn't until Jackie Woodson, who used to joke, Meg, you want to make money? Take out the line breaks.
You know, make the poetry look like prose.
Yeah, exactly. And then Jackie sends me a manuscript of hers, and she'd already written some award-winning novels at this point. She sends me a manuscript.
Locomotion.
And she wants me to read this before she sends it to her editor. And it was then that I realized, oh, I could write a novel in poems. You know, I had read Out of the Dust, which is probably the first young adult verse novel out there by a woman named Karen Hess. Mm-hmm. But I never saw it as a model for myself until Jackie wrote Locomotion. And then it was like she threw down the gauntlet and she opened my eyes at the same time. And immediately,
like a proof of concept in a way, huh?
Yeah.
It can be done.
And then I said, oh, I have to try this. And I already knew my character was a girl around age 14. She was the youngest of three adopted children, growing up in a very loving house filled with certain silences.
And that character is Lizzie McLean.
And that's Lizzie McLean.
Lizzie's story is based somewhat on your own life, and without giving too much away, you know, it's kind of a suspenseful last book. Can you tell us a little of that background, of your background that led to Lizzie's story?
Yes. I was the youngest of three adopted children, all of us adopted from the New York Foundling in Manhattan, and from different families. And I was that kid who was growing up in a very loving home filled with a lot of silence, which was really about not necessarily the facts of our adoptions and the what mom and dad were doing, for example, when they got the phone call from the New York Foundling saying, would you like another kid? You know, but we didn't talk about our feelings. And when I realized that that was taboo territory, I had to find another way to express myself and to, you know, talk about things that were important to me without.
And that was through Lizzie as a
and
character
that became,
and through her story.
That became, right. And that it took me years and years to figure out how to do that, to put on the mask, per se, of Lizzie McLean.
And that allowed you to open up?
Exactly,
oh.
Yeah.
So it was somewhat cathartic?
Right, so Lizzie books, could so? Say things that I couldn't.
Ah.
Yeah.
And hopefully speaking for other readers in the audience who might be going through the same situation.
Right, right. Yeah, and not necessarily just other adoptees, but a lot of people kind of have questions about
I didn't mean
who
just
they are and where they come
about
from.
Their birth mother,
yeah.
But other secrets that they might
right.
not be able to talk about in front of their parents or their family.
Yes, I think every family has that.
Now, in the first book, The Secret of Me, Lizzie is 14 years old. In the second, The Girl in the Mirror, she's 17 and about to graduate high school.
Right.
And in the newest one, When You Never Said Goodbye, she's 18 and she's in college at NYU. All three books, to me, and I think to all readers when they go through it, cohere into one continuous story and build on each other so well that I thought you planned the trilogy before writing the first book. But I was surprised to learn through your interviews, previous interviews, that you wrote The Secret of Me and figured that would be a standalone book. Why'd you write the second book to continue the story then, and then the third to somewhat conclude it?
That was my editor's idea. She really wanted Lizzie to actively search for her birth mother. And having been through a search for my own birth mother, I really believed that in order for someone to be emotionally ready to do that, you should be at least 18. So I said, okay, if you're okay with me writing a young adult novel in the voice of a girl who's 17, 18 years old, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. So that's when I started to write The Girl in the Mirror. But I was very resistant too, because, you know, writing a book like this, I take on this character very personally. You know, I kind of step into her body and into her voice. And to go through the emotional roller coaster that is a search for one's birth mother was very daunting to me at the time, because it was all very fresh for me. So I do something in the beginning of The Girl in the Mirror that throws Lizzie off course. And you know...
Yeah, I actually have a question about that.
Okay. Yeah, so by the end of the novel, you know she's going to search for her mother. But... So I actually thought that I could get away with just writing book two, and that would be the end, and Lizzie goes off and has a nice life. And when I sent that manuscript to my editor, she said, well, we love this book, but obviously this is a trilogy.
It would have been obvious to me too, but not to you at the
right,
time. Huh?
Right, right. Ah. Yeah. So I went into book three kind of kicking and screaming, and in the end I knew this was right. I really needed to go on this journey with Lizzie. And at that point, I guess I made myself ready, and we did it. Yeah.
I'd like to give our listeners a feel for the trilogy and the power of the verse in the books. You set up the story very concisely early in the first book. Could you please read the poem for us, Two Mothers, from that book?
Sure. Yeah. Two Mothers. I have two mothers, but not like Toshi, who has two mothers, who live with her in New Hook and brag about how much she looks like one and acts like the other. I have two mothers, but only know the second one. My first mother loved me so much, she gave me away. I wonder if it bothers my mother, the one who took me in, that I don't look like her. I wonder if she ever worries that my other mother will want me back. I wonder if she ever thinks of me, my other mother. I hope no one ever loves me as much as she did. What kind of love is that?
Oh, thank you. And yeah, it's just the power of verse there. You know, just concise and emotional. And
yeah, thanks.
Now, in the second book of the trilogy, I want to concentrate more on the third book, final book here. So, but going through, just to set this up for our listeners, The Girl in the Mirror, Lizzie's now 17. She's a high school senior. And for a teen, that's a pretty big jump. It doesn't seem like that to me, three years, but going from 14 to 17 for somebody
huge,
that age.
Right.
Since the book is all told in Lizzie's voice, how'd you go about changing that voice from Lizzie at 14 to Lizzie at 17?
Oh, that's such a great question.
It worked for me, but I didn't know how the magic was accomplished.
Though. I've actually have a lot of my journals that I was keeping at that time in my life, and I've been rereading them even recently and realizing how my own vocabulary was changing from age about 10 to 18, and it's kind of remarkable to watch that my prose getting stronger and my vocabulary getting wider and deeper. And so that's what I was thinking about when I was taking on that voice of Lizzie at an older age. And I think because I'm so close to her and really able to inhabit her, it came quite naturally.
So based on your own personal experiences in your journals, not necessarily going out and researching 14-year-olds versus 17-year-olds.
We've already been there and done that, and I just happened to be very much in touch with that teenager self of mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kinda, like I said, it works very well.
Thanks. Yeah, you put on the mask and you see what she says.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Meg Carney, author of the new book, When You Never Said Goodbye, a novel in poems, and journal entries. Now, we alluded to this before. The second book starts with two major events, actually. One, Lizzie receives a letter from the adoption agency that her parents helped her receive, apply for.
Yes.
And her father dies of a heart attack.
Right.
And that's before the book begins, actually, so somewhat off stage, in a sense. I'd like, before discussing it, if you could read a very moving poem that is at the very beginning of the book, The Day My Father Died, and then maybe tell us a little bit about the poem's form and why you used it here.
The Day My Father Died. I thought it was a joke. They called me out of class. Mom's voice said Dad was dead. I dropped my phone. They sent me home. They called me out of class, said I should call my mom. I dropped my phone. They sent me home, where everything was surreal. They said I should call Mom, but her voice was strange, a stranger's. Everything was surreal. Our house was filled with people. Mom's voice was strange, a stranger's. Lizzie, she said, and hugged me. Our house was filled with people who wanted to hug me, too. Lizzie, Mom said, and hugged me. We stood that way a long time. Other people wanted to hug me, too. I wanted them to leave us alone. We stood that way a long time. Neither of us could cry. I wanted everyone to leave us alone. I wanted this to be a bad dream. Neither of us could cry. Crying would mean it was true. I wanted this to be a bad dream, but I heard heart attack and car. Crying would mean it was true. Dad had pulled the car over. He knew. But I heard heart attack and car and wanted to shout, "You're all lying!" Dad had pulled the car over. He knew it was his heart exploding. I wanted to shout, "You're all lying!" Where was Dad? He'd show them. It wasn't his heart exploding. It was April 1st, a trick. Where was Dad? He'd show them. He'd walk through that door. It was April 1st, a trick. Mom's voice said Dad was dead. He couldn't walk through that door. I thought it was a joke.
Oh, my. Now, what is the form in that poem? You use, obviously, repetition very effectively.
Yes. So that is called a pantoum, which is a French form, and it's very circular, which, like the villanelle, is perfect, really, for kind of an obsessive subject.
Yeah, and from the new book, we'll have you read a villanelle.
Yeah, there's quite a few of those in the new book.
I should mention to listeners that in the back of the first two books, at least, you include something called A Guide to This Book's Poetics, where you explain forms like the pantoum and the villanelle, and in addition to different types of rhyme.
So with the idea that if young people are curious about how this poem is put together, how do you make a poem like this, or why would you choose a sonnet over a villanelle or a sestina, then it's all in the back. And I do that for book three also. I just, instead of putting it in the back of the book, it's on the website only. But and there's also free teacher guides on the website to all three books. But the pantoum is very circular, as you heard. The trick is it can be any length, but you know when you feel like you're getting toward maybe the end of the poem, you know you're going to have to repeat the first line as also the last line.
Oh.
So that you hear all those repeating lines, because the first line and the third line of the first stanza, or what other people might think of as a paragraph, have to repeat as the second and the third line of stanza two. Hmm. And then the first and third line of stanza two becomes second and fourth lines of stanza three, and so on. And those lines have to keep repeating like that until you get to your last stanza, where you then repeat stanzas one and three in reverse order.
Which mirrors, no pun intended, Lizzie's thoughts.
Yeah.
In terms of her dad's heart failing and exploding and a heart
attack. Right. And kind of echoes, you know, how the mind works when you get news like that. You know, everything's kind of spinning around in your mind. And so the form, you know, we talk as poets a lot about form and content and how you want the form really to hold up the content and reflect the content of the poem. And I think that's a really good example of that.
Yeah, you had one line. This is from the new book, The Workshop Challenge, from Liz's creative writing professor. Uh-huh. And the creative writing professor tells Lizzie, when the subject feels dangerous, form is your friend.
Right.
Do you want to explain that in relation to the book and the different forms you use for
the
poems?
And forms meaning, you know, pantoums or sonnets or villanelles or sestinas, any kind of formal verse
even a
like
few
that.
Haikus there.
Yes, yeah. When you have a form that's providing you a structure, it can be a kind of safe house. Especially when you have something difficult you want to talk about or express, you have something kind of holding you up. You have something saying, well, you have to have 14 lines in this sonnet, and it has to have this certain rhyme scheme, you know, and maybe every line has to have a certain number of stresses or a certain number of syllables. And when you start thinking about all of these things that you have to fulfill structurally, it takes a lot of pressure off you emotionally, and you can kind of spend time thinking about the rigors and demands of the form and less about, you know, oh my goodness, I can't believe I'm about to say this.
So even though there are all these constraints in following the form, it's freeing, liberating in a way.
It can be very freeing, and you can end up saying things that you wouldn't have said otherwise. You surprise yourself a lot of times when you're writing for a form because you're shooting for a number of syllables or a certain rhyme, and you say a word that you wouldn't have used otherwise, and you realize, oh wow, that's even more perfect than I ever could have planned if I didn't have the form kind of leading me to that word, you know.
Now, the third and final book, Meg, When You Never Said Goodbye, begins on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. Lizzie is 18. She's just transferred. She started at Syracuse, I guess, in the fall, Syracuse University.
Right.
She lives in upstate New York.
Yes.
Or above New York City.
Yeah, she lives in the Hudson Valley.
I grew up in New York City, so everything right. north of there is upstate.
Right, even the Bronx.
Right, even the Bronx, yeah. No, we make allowances for the Bronx. And she transfers to NYU, so in New York City. And you set up her reasoning for the transfer with a type of poem called a villanelle. So mm-hmm. you'd mentioned that. And now we'll actually, hopefully you'll read this for us. This one's called Birth Mother Villanelle. And I was interested in if you could read it, Meg, but also maybe describe the villanelle form and how it's used here.
Okay. Birth Mother Villanelle. She must be here in New York, my first home. This isn't some adoptee fantasy. I feel it in my gut, my bones. The only other mother I have ever known says she, too, thinks it a possibility. She could be here in New York, my first home. City of concrete, of glass, of lights and stone. Islands surrounded by rivers and sea. I feel it in my gut, my bones. This birth mother's inspired many a poem, even though she's a stranger, a mystery. She must be here in New York, my first home, and maybe hers, too. Perhaps she never roamed, so didn't want me growing up in her city. I feel it in my gut, in my bones, that she'll welcome me now that I'm grown. I could be as close as the sand is to sea. She must be here in New York, our first home. I feel it in my gut, in my bones.
Ah, beautiful. And you mentioned in the Guide to Poetics that the villanelle is used for poems of obsession, and here it's very clearly the central obsession of the trilogy, which
right.
is Lizzie's search for her birth mother.
Exactly, yeah. And you can see that it's also kind of circular and repetitive the way that the pantoum was. So really, when you write those first three lines, because this is the villanelle is set up in what they call tercets, or lines of three. You know that your first and third line in that first stanza are going to keep repeating throughout the poem, and then they will wind up as your last two lines of your last stanza.
So similar to the pantoum, so that sense of repetition is gives you that obsession.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I read all three books, and I read them actually as one continuous story. But the third book, I think there was a certain point, probably towards the beginning of the book, where I didn't even realize I was reading young adult anymore.
Good.
It just seemed like a great story with strong characters that I cared about. In fact, it was somewhat like a good mystery, and you even throw in at least one red herring, and I won't tell readers what that is. Also, there's this red herring could be considered what in a Hitchcock movie is called a MacGuffin, you know, kind of an obsession but a wrong turn in a lot of ways. Was that one of your objectives, to ratchet up the suspense and the pace in the third book?
It wasn't my intention. It just sort of happened. You know, sometimes when you're really in a story, it's almost as if you're watching this movie unfold in your mind, and you and these characters start walking onto the stage, and you didn't expect them, and you go, "Oh, hello, who are you? What are you here for?" And you just kind of have to go with it. So that the character who you're talking about, who kind of becomes that red herring, came out of the blue to me, but it all kind of made sense, because from the very first book, Lizzie is obsessed with looking for women on the street or in the little store where she works, you know, as a high school student, and
yeah,
and you know, at the laundromat or the supermarket, just looking for someone who looks like her.
And she's somewhat sure of herself that she's going to find her birth mother in New York City.
Yes.
Which is why one of the reasons she's at NYU.
Right, because she was born in New York, and her adoption agency was in New York.
Now, Megan, in one of the book's journal entries, you include some journal entries in prose in addition to the verse. You write that lyrics are like poems but different. They seem to need the music to make us feel their true power, like a play needs to be acted, or at least an actor's voice, for its words to have their full impact. And you wrote a song with the title, the book title, When You Never Said Goodbye, for the book, included the lyrics in the appendix, and you had a colleague, a friend, write the music for it, and someone else perform it on guitar and a singer there. What did you find was the difference between writing song lyrics and writing the poems in the trilogy?
Yeah, in the beginning, I thought, oh, well, you know, how different can writing a song be from writing a poem? And yet when I sat down to do it, I was a total failure. So I started, I got a kind of like song lyric writing for dummies kind of book.
Really?
You know, yeah, I did.
Well, rather than looking at actual models.
And then I started,
like Joni
Mitchell. Right, and then I started looking at actually Joni Mitchell lyrics and James Taylor lyrics. And it's almost like writing a formal poem, but and you almost have a little bit more freedom to be kind of corny. You know, like Bob Dylan couldn't get away with a lot of his lines if they were.
Yeah, he's a Nobel Prize.
He know he is. He is. And God bless him. Yay. You know, but it was just, it was a lot more challenging than I expected. So I have a poet friend who's also a wonderful songwriter and musician named Cornelius Eady, and I sent him my first draft of the song, and he just made some notes on the first verse, and I was really writing too much, I think. I really had to cut out a lot of words, and you know, you have to think more about what's really sayable in a line in a different way than you do when you're writing a poem.
And you're not necessarily telling a story in the song lyrics so much as kind of forming some impression in the listener's mind,
right,
I guess is
right.
what I'm trying
so
to
there's
say.
A bit of a story in the song, but it is a more impressionistic kind of thing.
Yeah, I find that about a lot of song lyrics that I like.
Yeah.
You're not quite sure what's going on, but you get the picture, and maybe part of that is the music that accompanies the
lyrics. Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so I didn't feel as if the song really came alive until these friends set it to music and performed it, and then wow, I was really blown away. What a gift, you know, to be able to collaborate with other artists in that way and see your words become this whole other thing.
And for listeners who are interested, this program actually begins with an excerpt from Meg's song and will end the same way. And if you like, you can go to Meg Carney's website or YouTube. It's up and listen to the whole song.
Yeah, and I have the lyrics on the website too.
Yeah, and in the book.
Yes, and in the book.
Well, Meg Carney, thanks very much for talking with us at KBOO today.
Thank you, Ken. This was wonderful. I really appreciate it.
We've been talking with Meg Carney, author of the new book, When You Never Said Goodbye, a novel in poems and journal entries. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Meg for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.
Maybe I'd reach the day when maybe you said be good, when maybe you said don't cry, when maybe you said I love you, when you never said goodbye.
Join KBOO at the Holiday Comic Spectacle of Arts on Parade on Thursday, December 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Hosted by the Soft Skills Comics Collective, this benefit for KBOO and the Independent Publishing Resource Center will feature Pacific Northwest comic artists, live cello music, sing-alongs, science fun, and much more. Again, that's the Holiday Comics Spectacle of Artists on Parade on Thursday, December 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the show all about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we are coming to you today from the Oregon Historical Society, where the Wordstock Literary Festival